Okay, today I'm talking with John Sapir, author of Thriving on the Edge of Chaos. Welcome, John. Let's get started.
All right.
So let's start with a little bit about you. Who are you and what are your credentials for writing this book?
I'm the founder and CEO of a company called Silvertree Systems and also another company called Work Relay. Silvertree is a mid-sized custom application development company. We got clients like Adobe and DocuSign, so we're pretty well established. Work Relay is an enterprise work management system that runs on the Salesforce platform that brings together processes and projects in a single platform. And I've, of course, run many projects over my 35 plus years, so I'm not a stranger to project management, let's just say.
That's good. That's good. So the book is called Thriving on the Edge of Chaos, Managing Projects as Complex Adaptive Systems. What can you tell us a little more about the premise of the book and what led you to writing this?
Sure. Just a note on the Thriving at the Edge of Chaos. That's a complex adaptive system term that mm-hmm. talks about on the one hand you have order, on the other hand you have chaos, and in between you have the edge of chaos, and that's where things really happen, because you have too much order, nothing's going to change. If you have too much chaos, you can't do anything. So edge of chaos is where you want to be, where you want your organization to be.
Cool.
And actually, if you think about it in terms of project management, we try to go for the order side of that spectrum, but in fact, if it's a very complex project, you probably want to be at the edge of chaos, because it's going to be chaos anyway, right?
Kind of feels that way.
Yeah. Anyway, I got really interested in the concept of chaos theory and complexity systems from Jurassic Park, of all things. The whole premise of Jurassic Park is that a small change in a complex system can have big, unpredictable effects. It's an example of how of trying to apply what you would see as a complicated solution to a complex problem. An example of this is the war to topple Saddam Hussein. The idea was he is removed and we'll get democracy. Needless to say, the situation is much more complex than that, hence ISIS. The solution to a complex problem like this is very different from the one that was attempted. So once I understood the difference between something that's complicated and something that's complex, it was easy to make the jump to apply complexity concepts to the management of work.
So who is your audience for this?
So really anybody who's interested in understanding what complexity really is and complexity science, which tells you, you know, what are the properties of a complex system and how do you deal with them? You know, what tactics can you use to better manage complexity. So, you know, I think that aspect of the book, which really kind of is the first part of the book, is all about complex adaptive systems, which I think is interesting in itself. In terms of project management, I take some of the ideas from the first part of the book and apply it to project management. So really, I mean, anybody who's involved in complex systems or in running complex projects would be a good candidate for the book.
Interesting. So when I go to my project management meetings around town, I asked a few people, do you have any idea what a complex adaptive system is? And they looked at me like I had a head sprout, a third head. So what are complex adaptive systems?
Yeah, sure. So it's really, yeah, I've had the exact same experience. Nobody knows what a complex adaptive system is. But the theories have been around for the last 20 or 30 years, really, and are getting applied more and more as, you know, life becomes more complex and there are more things you have to take into account, and all that kind of jazz. But the best way to understand a CAS, a complex adaptive system, is through an example. If you think about what happens when a set of traffic lights at a busy junction cease to function, when the lights worked, you had a complicated system because you had rules and everything was programmed and you could predict how things were going to work. But if the traffic lights cease to work, there's a lot of hesitancy at first, but gradually a pattern emerges which the motorists recognize, and they all start to prosecute a time in each direction. And very often what emerges is more effective than the normal pattern. So this system, so it goes from being a complicated system, which is governed by rules and you know exactly what the cause and effect is, to something that's quite complex. There are no set rules in this case, but more importantly, it's adaptive in that the pattern changes as the circumstances change, hence complex adaptive system. So the system adapts to what the circumstances happen to be at that time, not through a kind of a command and control way, but just organically, if you like. Another way to describe complex adaptive systems is one in which the perfect understanding of individual parts does not automatically convey a perfect understanding of the whole system's behavior. So the behavior of the whole cannot be understood by the behavior of the parts. This is because there's no direct correspondence between cause and effect. The famous example of this is from chaos theory is where the butterfly flaps its wings in Australia and causes a storm in Texas. If it flaps its wings an hour later, the storms may appear in Canada instead of Texas. Obviously an exaggeration, but that's the basic idea. Mm-hmm. The point is that small changes can have huge effects that are totally unpredictable, and vice versa. You can make major changes in your organization, for example, but it doesn't have the intended effect. Again, too many unknown variables with no direct correlation between cause and effect.
So how does this relate to the projects that we manage?
Well, that's a good question. So, So the idea here is that if you try to apply a complicated solution to a complex project, and a complex project, I guess we could define as something that is, I guess the opposite of a simple project, but a complex project would be lots of people involved, maybe lots of departments, maybe external, just a lot of variables that have to be managed to make the project work. Mm-hmm. So what do? So we go in and we start planning, right? We start creating schedules, and we want to be really tight on our schedule. So we delve deeper and deeper into the schedule with this plan. But of course, it doesn't work out because things happen, right? Things happen, and when things happen, they become complex. So the question is, how do you deal with the complexity in the project? So obviously, coming up with an even more detailed schedule is not a good solution to the problem. And you have to use different techniques, which I think we'll cover in a little bit.
Yeah, I totally understand. And in the book, you talk a lot about the difference between complicated and complex. And to be honest, I don't remember ever talking about that with any management I ever had. So why is the difference important?
So something that's really interesting. There is it's called a sense-making matrix that was created by a guy called David Snowden, and it's called CYFENIN, spelled C-Y-F-E-N-I-N. And what he does in this matrix is he defines four quadrants of how things work, basically. So you have the obvious, where anybody knows how this thing works. There's only one way to do it. You can automate it. It's all good. So there's the obvious. And then you have the complicated. And the complicated is where there are different ways to do things, and you need experts to tell you exactly how to do them. So like, for example, I'm building an airplane. It's complicated, obviously, but it's not complex because you know exactly where the parts go and what they're going to do. And then the third one is complexity. So in a complex system, there's no linear progression from cause to effect. So this is kind of where you can't predict things because they're way too complex and you can't control them. Really, anything where a human is involved, right? Because humans are unpredictable. So when they can't be given strict instructions on what to do and things change all the time, it becomes a complex system. And then you have chaos where there's really nothing you can do to deal with the problem other than just, you know, whatever you can find, whatever way you can find to do, just do it now kind of thing. There are no patterns. You don't have to worry about any of that kind of stuff. Unlike in complexity, where you start seeing patterns merge as the system goes forward.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That makes sense, but
that does make kind of sense.
Okay. Let me give you another example. Actually, yeah. This is kind of a cool example. So Mike Tyson, the boxer, had a famous quote, which basically said, "Everyone has a plan until they get punched in the face." So you can come up with a detailed plan of how you're going to fight Mike Tyson, but it's really pointless. So the solution here would be make sure you don't get punched in the face by Mike Tyson. So
that's a good plan.
Yeah. So it's the same sort of thing, right? So you in a project, you know, you can come up with the most detailed plan you like, but as soon as you start executing it, you know, things start falling apart. So there have to be better ways of dealing with that uncertainty in a complex system.
Yeah, you know, when I talk to my peers in my local PMI meeting, they do understand the theory of constraints and CCPM, right? Critical chain project management.
Right.
And you bring that up in your book as well. How does that kind of roll into all the other pieces?
Yeah, so the theory of constraints is really a simple solution to complex problems. It provides a way to focus in a complex environment. So instead of trying to improve every part of the system, because every part of the system is related to every other part of the system, you just look for the step in the system that is causing the most pain, bottleneck, whatever, and fix that. You always believe, Goldratt, who wrote the theory of constraint, said there was always only just one part of the system that was the most impactful on performance at any one time. Now, this, of course, is, you know, in many circumstances, that's not necessarily true. But the idea is to kind of give you some way to focus. So it deals with the complexity idea that a change in one part of the system makes, you know, affects everything else at the same time. You can't possibly understand exactly, you know, which cause created which effect. So the theory of constraints helps you to kind of identify what you should be focusing on rather than trying to, you know, just go and deal with everything. CCPM gets a bad rap because the definition of CCPM focuses on the idea of taking the availability of resources into account when planning. This works well in the manufacturing environment, but in a system that includes people, it doesn't work quite as well. So for me, the real contribution of CCPM is the concept of buffer management. Buffer management is a great way to deal with uncertainty and provide early warning in a project management setting.
Mm-hmm. Ah, okay, that makes sense. So for your methodology, what industries or projects are best suited to your methodology?
Right, so this is actually kind of the crucial question, right? What I talk about in the book is primarily related to repetitive projects. We're not talking about software projects here. So, you know, if you think about projects, you have one-off projects, you have PSA type projects. Mm-hmm. But here I'm talking about projects like a company that installs solar panels. All right, so they have many different variables that are based on, you know, where it's going to be installed, who's installing it, what kind of equipment, all that kind of jazz, very complex. But I need to manage that process as a project, right? Because I need dates and I need to manage resources and things that you would normally do in project management that you wouldn't do in process management.
All right. People have to show up somewhere.
Sorry?
People have to show up somewhere.
Yes, people have to show up, unfortunately. And when that happens, things go wrong. And I'll give you an example in a little bit. But it really, you know, these kinds of projects like, okay, I'm doing an installation of equipment for my clients, or I'm running clinical trials for a pharmaceutical company. Those are the kinds of projects that you can really get benefit out of what I have in the book.
Okay. That makes sense. When I talk to my software development folks and I kind of try to explain this to them, they're like, huh,
yeah,
interesting.
Yeah,
not
it doesn't.
So
it
sure. Does,
no, it definitely doesn't work for software projects because every software project is different. I mean, you know, you've got the basic, you know, design, and then you've got, you've got your design, you've got your programming, you've got your testing, you know, all that kind of stuff is always the same in a software project. But the actual details of what goes on in that software project are always going to be different. Whereas the kinds of projects I'm talking about, the basic concept, the basic things that happen are always the same. So now you have the ability to spend time on improving, each step in the process so that, it works better, whatever. But it's a very different approach than you would use with a software project.
That makes sense. I can understand that. Okay, let's get more in the weeds. So you talk a lot about expert team member estimates, and they figure prominently in the book. And if I understand it correctly, you're saying that the PM basically takes the padding out of the estimates they get from the team and essentially move it to the end of the schedule and then create a critical path with essentially no padding. So you add it at the end and it's a buffer, and then you manage to the buffer.
That is
so. Am I right? 100%
right.
Okay.
So here's the kind of background to that. So I mean, every task estimate that we do is based on the worst case scenario because no one wants to be late. So even if a task could be done in 3 days, you probably estimate something like 6 days because there are a lot of unknown variables that could impact getting the work done in time. The problem is that all this padding is wasted if it's not needed. So instead, what you do is you give the workers the lowest estimate, which is called challenge time with some of our clients, which is a nice way of putting this is how much time you've got to get this thing done. Mm-hmm. One that you know can be done 50% of the time. So you're kind of confident it's going to be done in that minimal amount of time. But then you take the other 50% of the estimate and you put it into this project buffer. And if you need to use the project buffer in this particular task, you can use it. You can take some out. It's like, there's a big basket of time and you need extra time, you can take it out of the buffer. This is basically aggregation theory, which is the basis for all insurance policies. And after all, insurance is what we're looking for here. Mm-hmm. So you know that not every house you insure is going to burn down, so you share the risk with all the other houses. This keeps the cost of insurance down for each individual house. And also, this is the basis for the Affordable Health Care Act, right? So that the whole idea there is that if you have enough people in there, they can take out of the buffer when they need to, and people who don't need it, they don't take out of the buffer.
Ah, okay. I got it. As a PM, I do like this idea. But in my experience, showing management a buffer at the end of a schedule would just invite them to remove the time. Now the likelihood of success just plummeted. What do you say to this critique?
Oh, yes. This is a major, major, major problem. And the only way that I've found that it works is you have to sit down, the management team that's going to be responsible for this, and explain to them what it is that you're doing. I mean, it's common sense, really, at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean to say that management's going to get it, but, if you can explain it in a way that, it's really a five-minute explanation, and if they do they do understand it, then they're unlikely to, just remove the buffer.
Well, that would work. I could see that if you could just get them convinced.
Right.
In the list of benefits to your method, you talk about the elimination of student syndrome, which is waiting to the last minute, and then Parkinson's law, which is work expanding to fit the time, things all project managers are deeply familiar with.
Yes.
I just don't see either of these issues being eliminated. Can you help me understand why you believe that to be the case?
Sure. So, elimination is probably too strong a word, right? You're not going to eliminate all of that. But there is another important idea here that I talk about in the book called Focus and Finish. So the idea is that anyone who is going to do a task on the critical path must start the task as soon as they get it and stick to that task until it's completely done. So it's like, receiving a baton in a relay race. You get the baton, you run, you give it to the next person. So obviously, if this is done, you'll eliminate both student syndrome and Parkinson's law, because you incentivize the worker to get the task done as fast as possible from the time that they receive it. So that's the basic idea behind that.
Interesting. Okay. So later in the book, you mentioned that in order for this methodology to work best, management has to accept that staff members may not be busy all the time. I'm afraid this sounds unlikely, at least for the jobs I've held. How do you propose to get management on board with this?
Yeah, it's really a huge challenge. I agree. But it's necessary. I mean, it's like the analogy I use is like going to a restaurant and you have waiters running around trying to serve customers, but they're not enough waiters to do it effectively. So service plummets and you go out of business. But on the other hand, if you make sure that you have enough waiters, even though some of them might not be busy all the time, you know for sure that the service is going to be great. And that incremental cost of hiring waiters is infinitely smaller than losing customers because the service is bad. So this is it's a really key kind of concept here. And I think that we kind of, lose track of it. Oh, I don't want to hire another person. Yeah, but you don't want to lose the client either, right? So you really have to think of it in those terms.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense when you put it that way.
now try it on a manager. There you go.
Oh, yeah, that could get interesting. So do you have any case studies or research to support the validity of all of this?
Well, one of our clients, a clinical research organization, which is where we kind of played around with a lot of this stuff, had very strong management. So they understood all this stuff. So for them, it wasn't an issue. They understood that if they were, especially in their environment where there's so many projects going on at the same time, there are thousands of tasks and all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. You have to have a buffer of people because you just don't know what's going to come up. You know, you might have one project where you've assigned someone to, but then another project comes along earlier than you expected, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And the only way to deal with that effectively is to have, buffer, people that you can assign. Yes, they might not be busy, 100% of the time, but at least you can get the project done.
Yeah. That, I think, if you put it that way, maybe you could sell it. And, another question I got when I kind of passed this around with some of my peers is they kept going to Agile.
Oh, yeah.
So talk about the difference between this and Agile, since Agile is all the rage these days. Why should we use this process instead?
Right. So I think Agile is great for software projects. I mean, that's where it started, I think. And that's mm-hmm. really, where it's good at. Because there, you want to have a lot of flexibility and you want to be agile, right? But that's very different from managing a project that has, 1,000 tasks in it, and you know what those tasks are, and you have some idea of how long they're going to take, but it's just not the same thing. It's not like you have a backlog that you're trying to get through, and the basic types of things that you would do in an agile environment. So I think, for software development and maybe some other things like that, it's great. But for the kinds of projects I'm talking about, like clinical trials, for example, and digital marketing campaigns, not so good.
Okay, I think I could sell that. Okay. To wrap up, what exactly is the main takeaway you want folks to remember after reading the book?
I think the main takeaway is to just have a better understanding of the difference between a complex and a complicated environment so that you can apply the right solution to the problem. Instead of trying to force a complicated solution to a complex problem, understand what the complexity is and try and come up with things that can help you manage. I'll give you a quick example. Uber. Uber is a great example of this. So scheduling taxis is a complicated problem, right? You got to make sure that you got the roster right, the people come in, you put them in the right place. Very complicated, right?
Yeah.
But in fact, it's a complex problem. It's not a complicated problem. So Uber said, well, let's just, we'll just dispense with scheduling altogether. We're not going to have scheduling. We're going to let people schedule themselves. We're just going to have what are called attractors and boundaries. We're just going to tell them, you know, if it's raining, we're going to up the number of up the rate so that more people will come out and you know, become Uber drivers. And boundaries, you can't do this, you can't do that. And just by putting those attractors and boundaries, you've now eliminated the entire problem of scheduling. And you can do similar things like that in project management in certain circumstances.
Yeah. The whole Uber thing is fascinating. It's a fascinating study. I agree. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Anyone responsible for managing repetitive operational projects should take a look at my product, mm-hmm. Work Relay, at work-relay.com.
Cool. Are you planning to be in Denver anytime soon?
You know, I might. I will let you know.
Yeah, let us know. You know, the local PMI group is pretty big here, and they'd probably love to have you come and talk about this.
Oh, yeah, it would be great. I'd love to get some reaction.
Yeah. So where can people go for more information on you and the book?
So the best place is to go to the website, work-relay.com, because there's a whole bunch of stuff there, some articles that would be of interest. We have one in particular that I think would be very interesting to people managing projects called Processes Masquerading as Projects Are Hurting Your Business. So I would suggest anybody, you know, should read that white paper. And I think they'll find it very interesting.
Great. Well, thank you. I appreciate your time.
Sure.
And I hope this wasn't too painful.
Not at all. Thanks very much, babe.
Thanks. I'll talk with you later.
Okay. Bye.
Bye now.